Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
Hello, I'm Luke Jones. Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service. In BBC OS Conversations, we bring people together to share their experiences. This time, 1 year after civil war broke out in Sudan, our conversations include aid workers who've become used to negotiating with men with guns and residents who've been displaced inside the country multiple times as they try and escape the violence which has brought chaos to their homeland and keeps them separated from their families. It's been described by the United Nations as one of the worst humanitarian nightmares in recent history. Over the past 12 months, we've heard from people in Sudan who've been living through the civil war. And in this edition, we're reaching out again to hear what their lives are like now.
This is a very depressive and devastating feeling that we see our country is just slipping out of our hands like this.
A year of war has killed an estimated 14,000 people, though the figure is likely to be higher, and there are multiple accounts of violent atrocities. One person we've been in touch with is Mohammed, a medic. He's made the decision to remain in the capital, Khartoum, despite the city having been devastated in the clashes. I should explain the lengths that Mohammed has gone to actually let us hear his story. To get online in Khartoum, you need to go to an internet centre. You'll hear our guests refer to Starlink, which is the internet provision there. Mohammed has generously walked several kilometres to one of these centres for us, but unfortunately he was not able to make a live connection to us. But he did manage to send this message describing what life is like now.
I live in the capital, Khartoum, the capital of the city. I'm here with my family. Half of the family are in Egypt, refugees, unfortunately. And I'm here with my parents. I had to stay because they decided not to leave the house. Actually, most of the people who left their house were locked out. Yeah, they took everything from the houses. A lot of thieves everywhere. Insecurity is a normal thing now. We are out of electricity since the last of May. There is no water for the past 2 weeks. We use solar energy and generators to turn the water pumps so we can get water, but now we don't have water. We have to cross like 2 kilometers daily to get some water. Things are not getting any better around here. I'm a doctor, by the way. I lost more than 3 or 4 patients because of malaria. They could be managed well if we had hospitals. We have like 2-3 hospitals working at the capital, but they are working with 10% of the power. So we can provide anything to those people who dies out of nothing. We believe that one day things are getting better, but the situation is not close to better now.
Sudan is one of Africa's largest countries. The civil war is essentially a power struggle between the country's military and its former ally, the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group. You'll hear reference to the RSF during our conversations. The fighting has driven an estimated 8 million people from their homes and forced thousands to flee to neighbouring countries. It's been described as one of the greatest population displacements on Earth. My colleague James Reynolds spoke with 2 women, both separated from their homes and families, Arija and first Omnia, both recent university graduates whose lives stopped when the fighting began.
Life has changed completely from what it was. We lost everything. But I would also say it's a year of resilience and strength that I did not know I had in me.
What kind of things have you endured and experienced over the past year?
I have experienced displacement 4 times I have experienced living in a war zone under bombings and shellings and mass shootings. And I have experienced raids and getting looted and being afraid of sexual violence.
Omnia, looking at some of your journeys, I mean, one of them took you, what, 49 hours on the road to get to safety?
Yeah.
What was that
yes.
like?
It was a very nerve-wracking journey because we had to go through different routes out of fear of airstrikes, encountering the militiamen and, you know, looting points and stuff. So we had to go through roads that are not usually used for traveling. So it took so long and it was very tiring and exhausting and super scary as well, because we've heard that there are people who basically rob on those roads. So we're just very nervous and scared, but we got through it. And that's what matters.
I want to bring in Arija. How has the last year been for you and your family, Arija?
For me, last year was very stressful, and it's just like a nightmare. People lost everything, being displaced, being away from my family. Actually, till now, I couldn't meet my family because when the war escalated, I was in official mission in South Kordofan, and my family was back in Khartoum, and then they got displaced. Then after a while, all the routes got dominant by RSF, and it was impossible for me to go to meet them, and also seriously hard for them to meet me. Now it's 1 year, and I haven't seen my family. Last time I was in my house, it was 10th of April, just 5 days before the crisis. Until now, I couldn't get back home. And due to several reasons, my family preferred to go back to Khartoum. And now they are staying in our home in Khartoum, and still I am not able to meet them again.
How do you stay in contact with them? Are you able to speak to them on the phone?
Yes, there is the Starlink connection. So we set up a daily call at 7 p.m. And sometimes for them, it's difficult to tell me like any kind of details, because sometimes RSF people are moving around, so they can't speak freely. And when they want to tell me something special in home, they do the voice note via WhatsApp. And when they arrive to the Starlink, I just receive the message.
Omnia, our first guest, listening to Arija. What are your thoughts?
I can relate a lot to what she's saying, because I still have family as well in conflict zone. And it's very, very hard to contact them. Like, my aunt is in Madini. We used to live with her before our second displacement. To be able to talk to us, she has to go to those Starlink centers, which, by the way, they are held by the RSF, and you have to pay insane money to get like an hour of internet. And like Arija said, we cannot really know what's happening with them fully, because the RSF men would be roaming around them, so they cannot be honest with us about their situation and the hardships that they are facing.
Omnia, what are your thoughts about further travel?
By further travel, do you mean like other states or outside of Sudan?
Or both.
For other states, I think because now I'm like in the northern side of Sudan, it's kind of safe to go deep into the north and the east. But I cannot go back to the center like Khartoum or Madani, which Khartoum is my original state. As for outside of Sudan, I think it's very impossible at this moment due to the financial situation. And also, it's very hard to get visas like anywhere, like to Egypt or to Ethiopia or Eritrea. And I've heard that the borders are not safe either to cross.
Looking back at the time before the war broke out, what do you miss from your previous life, Arija?
For me, I miss everything about my life before the crisis. I used to love my life in Khartoum. And I didn't even think like for one day that I want to go outside Sudan or outside Khartoum, because I had everything, like very nice work, very nice network of family and friends. Everything anyone can dream about, I had it back in Khartoum.
Omnia, what do you miss from before?
This one is a little bit hard to answer because I miss everything. Like, I think that I took a lot of things for granted. I think that I was very privileged and I had everything I wanted, in that I should have appreciated everything more. Like back in 2023, I had just graduated and I was top in my class, and I was offered a place at my unit work as a teacher assistant. And I had amazing friends and amazing family. Like, I had everything I wanted. And I was looking so forward to what life is going to bring in for me. But yeah, it was all taken away now.
And when you say it's taken away, Omnia, how do you look at your own future then?
Let me be honest with you. I don't want to be grim and depressing, but I don't see one. I don't see any future or any light at the end of the tunnel. Like, everything is so grim right now.
You don't allow yourself even to think, you know, a few months, few years down the line?
Few years, few months down the line, I don't see this conflict ending. And if this conflict doesn't end, I don't see a life for myself, because I'm trapped in here. I cannot go out and I cannot leave my family. And this conflict doesn't seem like it will end anytime soon. And unfortunately, it's expanding. Honestly, I don't even think I would be able to, like, I don't even think I would survive until that. If the conflict goes like how it is right now, like if it expands more.
Arija, how do you see the future? Well, in a similar way to Omnia or different?
For me, I am more looking into things in a realistic way, like the average of wars in Africa and third world countries such like Sudan. It takes around 5 to 7 years if we are lucky. And for me, what I am worried about is my little sisters, because they are still in the age of the universities. And I keep thinking about them. I need to figure out a way of getting them outside of Sudan to continue their journey of education. And this is really what I am worried about. And also my parents, the health system in Khartoum or in Sudan in general is getting worse and worse every day. So I can't say I see no hopes, actually, but it's challenging and everything is just extra stressful.
I'm Luke Jones, and from the BBC World Service, you're listening to BBC OS Conversations on War in Sudan, 1 year on.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
Leute, es wird unangenehm, denn ich muss euch einfach fragen, habt ihr euch eigentlich schon mal um eure Versicherung gekümmert? Hier ist übrigens Tara vom Podcast Tara sagt was und ich sage euch, es wird allerhöchste Zeit, Ordnung in euer Versicherungschaos zu bringen und dabei kann euch die App Clark helfen. Da arbeiten ganz viele Expertinnen, die das hauptberuflich machen, man glaubt es kaum. Und mit meinem Code TARA60, alles groß und zusammengeschrieben, könnt ihr euch sogar einen Shopping-Gutschein sichern, 60 Euro, bei zum Beispiel Amazon oder Douglas einlösbar, mit dem Code TARA60.
As well as struggling to see a future, many in Sudan say theirs is a forgotten war, with the world more focused on the fighting in Gaza or Ukraine. The need for humanitarian aid is vast and difficult. For many people, there is no food, and there have been warnings that this could be the world's largest hunger crisis. Our next conversation is with two aid workers who have themselves been displaced by the fighting, Asma and first Samreen.
I've been working in the aid sector for almost 9 years, but for the first time, it's just a different feeling. These people came from the same city that I lived in, same neighborhood, went to the schools. They were from the streets I grew up in. We share so much with the people that we are helping. Our families themselves had to flee, had to go to other locations. So it is just kind of a very much different feeling.
Asma, what's it like for you?
I think it's very much the same as Samreen has just reflected. Maybe we were privileged before when we were maybe in our homes, in our cities, in our jobs. But even the way that we had to flee, for example, the way that I had to flee Khartoum was the same as everybody else had to. And I think what shocked me the most that I'm mainly working with migrants and refugees and the issues that they encounter around access to documentation and all of that. For me, it was very striking that we had almost to go through the same experience now, especially in the early months of the conflict when the government system was not in place. So we could not have access to renew our passports, for example, or national IDs and all that. So it felt very chaotic, and it felt, even being an aid worker and somehow considered privileged in this country, it didn't feel like we had that anymore. And even the day-to-day life is just becoming much difficult than it used to be.
So you're both aid workers going through some of the same really difficult circumstances that the people you're helping are going through. Let's go back then. Over the past year. Samreen, what has this year been like for you and your family?
When the war happened, I wasn't in country, but my whole family was. I always get emotional talking about it. And I decided to come back at some time, but just how you lose everything overnight. And it's not only the materialistic value of that, it also the emotional value. This is, my dad was alive when the war happened. He was bedridden. And then they had to take him all the way. And then when they arrived to Egypt, they were able to leave the country, finally, after a really, really long trip. He passed away. And right now, I don't have access to a single picture. He was big on photography. He was very big on documenting every piece of our lives. And then suddenly, I don't have access to that. So it just feels like it's unfair, like you're robbed of everything. It's how you've been uprooted of your whole life, the memories, the places that you grew up in, the community that we have built over the years. And sometimes we feel like this life before the war had been just a distant memory. Some days it's just so difficult to go on knowing that it's just never going to be the same.
You mentioned your dad's photo collection. Where is it at the moment? Is it in an abandoned house in Khartoum?
Yeah, it's in our house that we fled. And right now, we have zero pictures with him from our childhood. And I tend to think about it a lot.
Thank you so much, Samreen. Let's go back to Asma. What has the year been like for you?
I think it was a very difficult year, especially that I'm not able to see my family since last July. We fled Khartoum together, but then they head to another state where our hometown is. And because of my work, I had to go to a different location. And I think what describes the year as a whole is that you're always feeling lonely. You're always feeling like this is not ending. Like the volatility of the situation is really affecting us. We're always very much anxious. I feel like I don't know myself anymore because it feels like we're just being very pragmatic about life. We're very much in our survival mode. It's only about surviving, making sure that our families are safe, they have access to money and all that. But to some extent, our personalities are lost within the process.
In the times that I've been in disaster zones or war zones as a journalist, I've often run into aid workers, and I'm struck by how many people are always going up to aid workers saying, do you know anything? Or when will the war end? Or do you have any more information? And I'm wondering if that's the case with you both when you're out in the field and you get so many questions. Samreen, is that the case with you?
It's not only about the war, when is it ending? It's just asking for help and sometimes how helpless we feel. Because at the end of the day, it's a bigger machine, if I may say. There's the program, there's verification processes, donors, everything. And it's very hard when we go to locations and people are really, really dire situations. And they ask for food, they ask for education for their kids, they ask for things that are just basics of the basics. And they are living in very horrible living situations. And we know there's nothing we can do. And that's always very hard. They're living in, I may say, unlivable conditions, to be honest. And people are asking just for ventilation. They're asking just for food. And knowing that there's so little that we can do if the war does not stop, that the whole situation is just bigger than us all. So from my personal experience, whenever we go, even if it's not the gathering point, but all around the country, that you'll find people just knowing that you're an aid worker, they ask you for stuff, they ask you to flee the country, they ask you to help them to get to other safer location, they ask you to help them in asylum seeking, and there's so little that we can do.
When you know there's nothing you can do, or little you can do, how do you respond to their questions?
It depends, to be honest, because giving a false hope for me as well is really unfair. I feel I owe them honesty. I feel hanging to a false hope at this time is as bad as not getting the help that you need.
Asma, how do you deal with the many people who approach you asking for help?
I think it is the same as Samreen said. There is so little that we can do. The crisis is just bigger than all of us. This is on one side, but also there is another side. In Sudan, normally, there is some skeptical view of the international organizations. So sometimes also we have to deal with this fact that sometimes people are kind of skeptical about our work, especially the security forces. So it has different elements of it that you have to deal with it almost on a daily basis.
Does that make it difficult, Asma? And I appreciate you might not be able to give fuller answers on this when you have to drive through checkpoints or negotiate with various commanders about aid getting through.
Yes, because even for us to deliver the aid in a timely manner, it gets very complicated dealing with the multiple security forces, for example, and the multiple stakeholders involved in the process, but also on a personal level. For someone who witnessed the conflict and then fled to a safer location, the last thing you want to do is to deal with armed men. And this is a fact. It's part of our job that we have to deal with them. And not only them, like the former security forces, but also because there is this increasing trend of the armed civilians who are being mobilized by the security forces. So on a daily basis, you have to encounter armed men, whether it's in the markets, in the security premises, it's everywhere. So it's kind of sometimes it feels like it's adding pressure and kind of sometimes triggers a bit of the trauma that we're having from the conflict. But at the end, it's a fact. It's part of our daily job and then something that we have to deal with.
And Asma, have you got pretty good at either negotiating or persuading armed men to let you and your teams through?
Yes, exactly. And part of the humanitarian work is to negotiate access.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're getting good at that.
Our next two guests managed to get out of Sudan. Nagwa El-Mamoun is in Toronto, Canada. We last spoke to her following the start of the war. But first, Dr. Safia Tariq, who's currently living in the UK, she recalls the dangerous journey she took on leaving her home in Khartoum.
The journey to the military airport where the evacuation process took place was really far away and incredibly dangerous. Checkpoints were basically full of rapid support force army men, and they were very violent and hostile. They would threaten you with a gun to your head. They'd look through your property. And the whole journey wasn't safe. We didn't understand the extent of it until we actually went ourselves. But you had no choice because staying back in Khartoum wasn't an option. There was no electricity. There was no water. You could hear the planes flying overhead, dropping bombs. You could see the explosions and you could see the RSF army men trooping around the area. They stole cars. They raided houses. My professor, who was my neighbor, was killed. And it was very devastating. It was one of the reasons why most people left the area, because he was a very well-known doctor. And knowing that something as brutal as killing a person in their own house and raiding their house, trying to steal their money, was just too difficult. It was horrible to bear.
I want to turn to our second guest, Nagwa, who is in the Greater Toronto area in Canada. And I know for your family, Nagwa, this has just been a terrible, heartbreaking time.
Yes, since we spoke from last year, I just lost four family members. Actually, one of them is my cousin. She's the only daughter of her parents, and she was shot inside her house. She died immediately. After 2 weeks, her father also passed away. He couldn't take it that his daughter passed away. And after 2 weeks, my aunt also passed away because she was just sitting in her house. And unfortunately, there was a bombing around in the area and she was just got shocked and she had a heart attack. And the last one was my sister-in-law. She tried to escape with her husband and unfortunately, she couldn't make it.
That is a devastating toll for one family, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a heartbreaking. And the more heartbreaking is that the international society is not making any action towards saving the people of Sudan. The situation is still devastating and deteriorating. Before it was just a war and fight. Now there is a rape and sexual assault and there is looting all around. And the more devastating thing is that international society is just looking at this situation without doing any action for the people of Sudan. This is very hard for us all. People are being displaced. The country is not safe anymore. And the world is just looking at us.
Both sides have been accused of committing war crimes, and both sides have denied it. There have also been attempts at a ceasefire, but so far they haven't worked, though there is the possibility of more talks involving the US, Saudi Arabia, Egypt and the UAE, but a large question mark hangs over their potential success. So it's possible to see why NAGWA and our other guests feel the world currently appears powerless to help end this war. Many thanks to everyone who joined us on the programme. We appreciate their courage in telling their stories, and we hope they and their loved ones are all able to stay safe. And just to say, if you've been affected by what's happening in Sudan, you can find help and advice at the BBC Action Line. I'm Luke Jones, and you've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.